So this is Kevin. Thank you for listening to the Hold Fast podcast. I'm sitting here today with Keely Boston and her beautiful young child, Ollie. So if you hear some childlike sounds in the recording, that's why. He's here to be a part of this conversation today. Apparently, Siri is too. Not too long ago, Bob and Gracie, who are the founders of Tierra Nueva, were really looking for somebody to come into a staff meeting and share their strength, experience, and hope, as well as their education in ministering or working with people in a marginalized context, more specifically in direct involvement to mental illness and drug abuse and drug addiction. Keely is somebody who very first popped into my head, because not only does she have life experiences, but she also has an extensive history in working with people who live and spend their whole life in that context. So she came in and she's done a couple of trainings with us as a staff and has just basically made everybody fall in love with her and her compassion for those that we serve. It sounds like Ollie agrees about Keely's love. In that talk, one of the things that that you have said, Keely, is about being authentic in the people that we love and who we are, for us to change, not to expect them to change.
Yeah.
And also for in the importance of loving the unlovable. Why is it important to love the unlovable? I mean, let's just throw that question out there.
Such a good one. I wish I was prepared for that. There's so many different directions that I can go. It's important to love the unlovable. Everybody has a place in this world and, you know, in God's world, and everybody has a place. How can we love ourselves if we can't love anybody else, and vice versa? You know, I was the unlovable for a very long time, and people loved me to the very best of their ability, until I was able to love myself. And, you know, we're all agents of God. We all are in this world together. And, I really value community, and some members are of our community, are the unloved ones. And those are the ones, you know, we need to reach out to and help. And if you've ever felt true happiness or true joy, it's not necessarily by having a baby, a newborn baby, or, well, that is true joy.
Yes,
I take
is.
That back. Or getting a new car, let's say, or buying a house.
Yeah.
True joy, true happiness, the feeling of fulfillment in this world comes from having purpose.
Yeah.
And to me, having purpose is loving one another. You know, everybody has a purpose. And who am I to say what their purpose is? I don't believe their purpose is to lay in the gutter and wither away from drug and alcohol abuse or from mental illness. I believe their purpose, all of our purpose in life, is to be loved.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answered it. I rambled a lot.
No, it's beautiful. But it leads me to the next question. And by the way, for those who are listening, none of this is scripted. It's not like we're sitting here with,
good point.
With, you know, with poster boards, like saying, I'm going to ask you this question and I expect your answer to be this way. This is just a casual conversation between friends. You said something in one of your trainings that really struck me in a way that I'd never thought of before. And it said, sometimes having a mental illness can be a blessing for that individual because it introduces them into community.
Absolutely.
How does that work? You know, I've been diagnosed with several different things, you know, cookie cutter mash style, just because I'm in the middle of a crisis at the hospital.
Yeah.
But what does that mean for somebody to actually be like truly diagnosed schizophrenia, manic depressive, bipolar, whatever, and to the point of where they need to live in some kind of home like Ovenell's over here, and they're specifically in that community. How is that beneficial to them other than they have people watching them and making sure they got clean sheets?
Well, as human beings, we search people that we can relate to, that we can find a bond with, or that common connection. Excuse Ollie.
No worries.
And what more, you know, relative than, you know, suffering? You know, oftentimes people with mental health, they feel suffering and pain, and suffering and pain often brings people together far more than love and joy. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, so setting up a place, even a treatment center where people can come and, you know, share their suffering and their pain and their struggle with their mental health, and then gives them a chance to meet others that are dealing with the same pain. If someone with a mental health, you know, issue is going to reach out, it's because the pain has gotten great enough, mm-hmm. and they're choosing not to suffer. Having places like Tierra Nueva, you know, and our community mental health agencies, so that people can come and find others that are in the same pain, they can choose to, or not, it's their choice. They can choose to relate and maybe stop the choice of suffering. They find people that are genuine, that are genuinely going through the same problems that they have, much like, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, the same thing. We are people that normally would not mix, you know, but we come together for that common denominator because the pain is great enough and we want help. If that makes sense.
It does make perfect sense. In one of our trainings, you pointedly asked everybody in the group if they were for or against treatment.
Yes. That was a fun conversation.
It was a fun conversation. And the way you dealt with the one guy was just beautiful. I've been hearing that from several people who were in the room that day. Were just like, wow, the way Keely handled that was just amazing. I am naturally for treatment because I am a recipient of treatment. Mm-hmm. I did a drug intensive outpatient with Phoenix Recovery Services, the Genesis process through New Earth Recovery. But why, for somebody who doesn't have any concept, what would be the selling point of why treatment is important?
You know, even for somebody who has no concept of treatment, or in that particular case, had a concept, but it was a negative, there was some negative connotation towards treatment through experiences, his experiences of helping others.
Yeah.
And it didn't go well with treatment. One, maybe it didn't meet this person's expectations, or two, they may not have been ready. But I found it fascinating that really he was genuine enough to care and to explore that conversation with me. And it could have gone sideways real quick, but he was genuine and heartfelt enough to explore that conversation and bring it around to ultimately realize that he just wants what's best for any human being.
Yeah.
And that's what it comes down to, that whether it's treatment, whether it's a community involvement such as a church, whether it's the Genesis process, whether it's the YMCA, Alcoholics Anonymous, it doesn't matter, as long as, you know, whatever works for that person. And what was your question again? This is great.
You know, why should somebody, like, you know, say you had Bill down the street.
Yeah.
That lives close to a place like Sunrise or Compass.
Yeah.
And sees the influx of mental health or co-occurring. Why should Bill, when he sees it on his front doorstep, be pro-treatment?
Ooh, that's a tough one for Bill because it's so close to his home.
Exactly.
Yeah, and, you know, people, like I said, people that enter into treatment, they are entering because there's been either an intervention, legal or family, or their pain is great enough. And with mental health symptoms, if they're not treated, they can you know, they can, their behavior may not be societal norm, may not be appropriate. So Bill watching that out his front doorstep is for sure going to be possibly, I don't want to make assumptions. Thanks, Elvin. Could be turned off as he's seeing it through his window. I mean, people may be wearing a helmet and carrying a hockey stick, you know, through his parking lot and swearing at Jesus Christ or flipping off their reflection in the windows. And poor Bill, you know, this is what he sees when he looks out his front window. Maybe that's not what Bill wants to see. There's a gap there. And, you know, quite frankly, that's a big gap that's in society as a whole. And it doesn't have to be on their front doorstep. They see somebody walking down the street with a hockey stick and a helmet. You know, they're going to, they may not have a great perception. Yeah. Oftentimes I hear the word crazy. And that to me is just the most demeaning word that that I hear. We don't use it in my household.
Yeah.
Not for anything. But Bill, he's in a tough situation. Being as though it's on his front doorstep. Bill doesn't have to be pro-treatment. He, you know, gets to make his own choice. He sees a lot and he deals with a lot. And if Bill did not like or was not pro-treatment, Bill should find somewhere else to live. If Bill was pro-treatment, Bill can easily walk through the parking lot and hold somebody's hand into the treatment center if they're struggling to walk through that door.
Yeah.
Bill doesn't have to be pro-treatment. Bill gets to be whatever Bill wants.
One of the things that I really wanted to address with you today from your point of view, and I'm going to share some of my history in this, is the authority of what is the word for their, what is their title? The county health professional or the county mental health professional?
The DMHC? CDMHC. The title has just changed because it's a mental health professional / chemical dependency professional. So they have to be duly credentialed in order to detain someone for mental health crises or with Ricky's Law for chemical dependency crises.
And real quick, what is Ricky's Law?
Ricky's Law is the ability for the county to detain someone if they are a danger to themselves or others due to severe intoxication.
Okay. So in 2009, I went through a really rough rough patch. I was seeing a psychiatrist in Bellingham, and he basically became a candy man. With the amount of volume that he was giving me, I go to him about my anxiety. He'd be like, "Here's a prescription for two milligram volumes. You know, and if it doesn't seem to be working, go ahead and bump that up with two or three, and you know, run it into a five." And then I go back to him and be like, "You know, even that's not working." He'd be like, "Oh, okay. Well, here's some fives." And then you can bump that up to with twos or whatever. And the next thing you know, I'm at tens, right? And it kind of got to the point of like, where's my anxiety today? Am I white, blue, or yellow? You know? And in that, there's kind of a dual sidedness there too, because where I originally was going to the guy for help, then it also became like a little bit of a, hey, I like this. I'm going to start seeking out these medications. So there was some drug seeking in there too on my behalf. But it all accumulated to, I think it was January 2009. I basically poured a whole bottle of volume into my hand and ate it and slit my wrist and said, I'm done. The volume finally putting me under at the hospital as I showed up, you know, blood. When I came home, and this is where I wanted to talk about the people who come in to assess these instances. How do they not fail people like me? Because I felt like I was failed because I was brought into the hospital after all of that, slit my wrist, put through surgery to have my arm put back together. I still don't have feeling in half of my hand. And the mental health person that came in and saw me said I was free to go home and no longer a danger to myself. As the hospital psychiatrist is sitting there going, no, he needs to be admitted. Yeah. I feel like I was failed at the time. How would a family member say they're going through something like that with a family member and they feel like they're being failed by whoever comes in from the county? How would they proceed to advocate for care for said loved one? Yeah, it's kind of a long description, whatever, but.
Thank you for sharing your experience. Boy, I could go all over the board with that one. I want to make a couple corrections. At the hospital, there is not a psychiatrist present, typically. The hospital typically uses a mental health professional. If they can get a psychiatrist in, then that's fantastic. Psychiatrists are very few and far between. It's very hard to get psychiatry help around here, short-staffed. There are not very many psychiatrists in the field. It's a very hard profession. So being able to have a psychiatrist is very difficult. Not that a psychiatrist would know any better, because typically somebody that's coming in to make an assessment like this is really only gathering information from that specific incident. Mm-hmm. Unless you have a mental health caseworker, case manager, mental health counselor, an MHP, a prescriber, a family member, all writing affidavits on your behalf. It can be a difficult process to be detained. Let me explain what actually being detained means. It means that somebody appointed from the county is coming in and has the authority, and you can call it authority. I call it probably a burden. To be able to legally strip you of all of your rights for 72 hours. That is a huge judgment call to put on anyone. There's a lot of ruling out that they have to do. There's some assessing that they have to do. They have to rule out, was this drug related? Oftentimes the first thing that somebody does when the DMHP comes out rule out drugs and alcohol. Was this related to drugs and alcohol? It's a different process now. I've been out of the field for about 8 months. And I know they're still trying to fine tune the dual diagnosis part of mm-hmm. the drug and alcohol part of it as well. So I have not been involved on a drug and alcohol detainment, only mental health. And they rule out whether or not it's drug and alcohol related. Mental health beds are for mental health crises. Mm-hmm. If the person does their assessment, which is not based on a lot oftentimes, there's no case record, or if it was a one-time event and there's no record at the hospital on this person having done this continuously, they will lean on the side of not taking away somebody's rights. Because really, in all aspects, stripping somebody of their rights is brutal. Mm-hmm. It is brutal. It means that they do not have a voice for that 72 hours. It means that they are under observation and they are going to be held against their will for 72 hours. And that, I would not take that job for all the money in the world.
I remember...
It's a difficult situation.
So Dr. Kaiser was her name. She was she introduced herself as a psychiatrist at the hospital. Mm-hmm. And she said that she thought I needed to stay, and I agreed with her. Mm-hmm. And the mental health professional said no. And I just remember, I was so in and out of it from all of the Valium and the surgeries and stuff like that, that I just remember her chasing after this individual through the hospital, yelling at him because he's like, no, he can go home. A couple of days later at their earliest convenience, they released me. Mm-hmm.
Which I imagine they held you until you detoxed from Valium.
From Valium. They mm-hmm. released me with this giant thing on my arm and with like no follow-up for aftercare, any mm-hmm. of that. They basically just said, here's the surgeon that you go see to go get your stitches removed.
Sure.
And then I went to some kind of counselor in Bellingham to just looking for a direction to go. Mm-hmm. And she said that she thought that I really needed some kind of inpatient treatment because there had been several episodes of mental breakdowns up until that point that had landed me into the ER mm-hmm. from anxiety attacks to this or that. And then I finally, my dad was driving me. And I said, take me back to the hospital. And he goes, is that what you really want to do? And I said, yeah. I walked up to the ER desk and I said, see this, my arm? I was just in here a couple of days ago for trying to kill myself and I want to do it again. And it took that much extremism for them to take me seriously. And then my wife at the time signed off on a hold. And so I had my rights stripped. I was there for 72 hours. I remember the lawyers and the judges coming in. And I looked at the attorney and said, I don't need your help. This is where I need to be. I kind of had a moment of clarity of like, I need to get some help. And then they finally transferred me down here to Skagit. Mm-hmm. I was here for 2 weeks to get leveled out. But
that's an amazing story. You often do not find that people willing, you know, to mm-hmm. enter into a mental health. Those are few and far between as well. Detainment is, again, it's a huge, huge process. It's a lot of work, especially for somebody who doesn't want it, and there's no findings to say that this person is a danger, is going to walk out the door and kill himself. Yeah. Oftentimes, you know, family members see it. Yeah. They're terrified that this person's going to walk outside the door and kill himself.
Yeah.
People close to him see it, him, her, see it, and they're terrified as well. But when that person does not want it, they are going to do everything possible, manipulation tactics, everything to say, I don't want this, I don't need this, why am I even here? And if that person is able to articulate why they are there, why they should not be there, and that they are not a danger to themselves, unless there's, you know, a ton of findings to prove otherwise, affidavits, a big record on this person where they've done this multiple times, a DMHP or, you know, a county professional cannot hold them. It's illegal for them. They have to meet the criteria to be able to be stripped of their rights and held. And I know a little bit more about this particular situation, the mental health detainment, because I worked quite a bit with high risk mental health and drug and alcohol clients. And so I was a part of this process over and over and over, to the point where I knew the commissioners, I knew the public defenders, I knew the prosecuting attorneys. And behind the scenes, when that person is held, if and when they are held, behind the scenes, you have an entire team working for that person to try and stabilize them. And isn't revolving door. It doesn't shuffle them in, shuffle them out. You have an entire team that is saying, okay, is this person really in harm's way? Is this person in danger? You have a prosecuting attorney saying, show me the evidence. You have a public defender saying, well, the evidence doesn't state that. You have the person saying, either I want to be here or I don't want to be here. You have a psychiatrist at the hospital who's actually employed at the hospital up in the mental health ward, the mental health facility, who is determining medications, regimens, you know, going through every single test and talking with the patient as much as they can to rule out, you know, whether or not this person is in a psychotic, depressive, whatever kind of episode, all coming together to determine whether or not this person should stay after the 72-hour mark.
Yeah.
But again, that first step, that detainment, is difficult. It's been a shortcoming in the community, people bridging together. You know, oftentimes mental health agencies, drug and alcohol agencies aren't following up. They can't. They're short-staffed. They're pushed to the max. They don't have time to sit down and write a 30-minute affidavit.
Yeah.
Or they're not even included. They don't know that their client is at the hospital, you know, being evaluated for a detainment. They have no idea. So I know the agencies out there are working hard to coordinate and to, you know, bridge that gap. You know, I was on speed dial for the hospital when my clients were there. They had me after hours. They had me at 3 a.m. I was at the hospitals with my client as they were, you know, going through the evaluation process. I was giving my input, my, you know, my chart of history, my historical events that yeah. led up to this event to whether or not this person was going to be detained or not. So it really is quite the process.
How in that process, though, do you meet the person that is in the episode with authenticity, love, care, and compassion? Because I know that when, from my own experience, when I was going through that process, in the area that they had me at the hospital in Bellingham, everybody that was there was very gracious and compassionate. They even gave me a little TV to watch Winnie the Pooh movies, yeah. whatever, just right. to, you know, they were very careful about what they brought me, though.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. No antennas.
But the support staff and even the ambulance drivers, because I was cabulanced down here, mm-hmm. There was almost an air of like...
Here we go again.
Here we go again, or sure. just another crazy, like you say, or, you know, or, here's another burden, you know. Here's another burden on taxpayers, or here's another burden on the hospital, or, you know what I, so.
Now, do you think that was actually true, or do you think maybe that's the way you felt at the time?
You know, I think the people that were actually, you know, I remember that psychiatrist that had chased the professional out yelling at him. Mm-hmm. I remember her happiness at me coming back, because she would come sure. see me every day to make sure I was okay.
Right.
And then the nurses were really cool. But, like, you know, I remember the ambulance guys being a jerk, you know, and really strapping me down. I'm like, do you really have to make it so tight to where I can't breathe? Oh, yeah. And just treating me like just like I didn't even matter. But the people at the hospital here in Mount Vernon on the third floor were super exceptional. They put up with my mood swings, and they just kind of let me be. My wife at the time dropped off a bunch of composition notebooks and some pens and stuff like that. And I just sat in the corner of the cafeteria in all my free time and wrote. And they just left me alone. It was great. And there was no condemnation there.
Sure.
But how, when people are in that place, like... I know it's a good thing. It's an easy thing to be like, oh, yeah, you got to meet them with love and compassion and let them know that they're not a burden. But how do you do that in the middle of that crisis? Like, you know what I mean? How do you pull any judgments that might be coming up in you away so you can just concentrate on the well-being of said individual that's really in need of love?
I think in order to answer that, what particular person or what role are you playing in this crisis? Are you the EMT worker? Are you the psychiatrist? Are you the mental health?
Family member. Because I remember...
Oh, okay.
I remember when I was going through mine, my wife at the time basically... my wife and her family basically turned me into that POS. How could he do this to her? You know, who cares about my suffering and what... why I did it, but how could I do that to her?
So as a family member,
yeah.
how do you practice that?
Yeah.
How do you give that? That's a tough one. You know, again, we put ourselves through the ringers. I say we because also, you know, I'm in recovery as well from drug and alcohol and mental health, and we put ourselves through the ringers, you know, to near death. But through your process of healing and recovery, I'm certain you've recognized just how much damage you've done to your family mm-hmm. as well. They're tired and yeah. they're burnt out and they don't know if this is going to be the last time that you're going to do this or if the next time you're actually going to succeed. I can't say that I know because I haven't, you know, been a family member. I don't have a family member that's in active addiction or suffers from mental health. But what I've gotten from my family is they didn't know whether I was dead or alive. They didn't understand why I kept doing these things. It didn't fit with their norm, their family values, you know, their family. I was certainly the outcast, and they could not figure out why I kept doing this repeatedly over and over and over again, why I was homeless, why I was running the streets, why I had a needle in my arm, why was I doing this, why was I in jail again? Don't call me. I got the tough love one. Mm-hmm. And for family members, we've tried for years as professionals in the field to work with family members to help them understand. Oftentimes, family members are very codependent. They care too much and it burns them out to the point where they're just done. They don't understand, so they get frustrated and angry. They view, like you said, the person as a POS, you know, piece of shit. They don't understand why this is happening. They haven't had this experience. They can't relate. Again, you know, it goes back to having a place where you can relate. Thank goodness there are churches and treatment centers and meetings out there where people can relate, because sometimes family can't.
Yeah.
And I'm not certain exactly what it is to take a family member, to help a family member understand. There are, you know, certain groups out there. There's Al-Anon for people who have family members that drink, or, you know, who themselves have codependency. There is NAMI, which is a National Alliance for Mental Health. Mm. And that's family members coming together to support their loved ones that have mental health issues or suffer from mental health. Education is the biggest thing that I can say if you're a family member dealing with somebody with a drug and alcohol addiction or mental health. Educate yourself before you can even begin to understand what the person is going through. You have to educate yourself and know exactly what it is they're dealing with before you can imagine how they're going through and how to deal with it. I guess that's a very difficult one. Family members often are not involved. And if they are, they're too involved, or they're misled, or they're frustrated and angry and burnt out.
Or this would all be better if they would just listen to me. Have you heard that one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, do it. You know, we've told him over and over, why does he keep doing this? He can't come to Christmas if he doesn't stop smoking meth. Well, I'm sorry. You know, he's smoking meth because he has voices that are going on in his head telling him Jesus Christ is going to kill him.
Yeah.
He gets a little bit of relief when he takes a hit of meth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry that you don't understand that feeling.
Yeah.
But how can they?
I understand that feeling.
But how can they?
Yeah.
You know, and or they let this individual, they can understand that feeling. So they let this individual come to Christmas. Well, this individual, their behavior is off. Everybody's scared. They're throwing plates. Christ is trying to kill them. It's a really hard dynamic.
So out there in the world, you see different tattoos.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to see if you agree with me in this. When you meet somebody with a tattoo that says "I am enough," or a semicolon,
mm-hmm.
you're meeting a warrior, because they have come to the realization that they are enough and that their story does need to continue. Do you agree with me in that? That when you meet somebody with those tattoos, you're meeting a warrior?
I'm not going to say no. I don't agree with you. I feel like any time that I meet anyone reaching out for help or not, every single person that is suffering, diagnosed or not, from a mental health disorder or drug and alcohol use is a warrior in my book.
Yeah.
They're doing everything in their power to just stay alive, to just deal with life, whether they're drinking to overcome pain, feelings, whatever it may be. Everyone is a warrior. Do I believe that just people in recovery are warriors? No. I think that every single person out there is most definitely a warrior. They are trudging the road to happy destiny. They may be on a different path. They may be trudging a little harder. There may be no happy destiny in sight. They may not want happy destiny. They may not even know Happy Destiny exists.
Yeah.
But they are for sure a warrior. They may not know about their potential. They may not know their purpose. But they are trudging. And damn, they're still alive.
Yeah. What are 3 points to loving the unlovable for us? What are things that, I mean, I can think of one is authenticity.
Authenticity. Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to lead a little bit here with into back to some of your teaching. Before, you know, authenticity, what are some, you know, I think we have to conduct ourselves in a certain way with a certain honesty and authenticity in ourselves.
Yep.
To be able to love the unlovable.
Yeah.
So once we get to that point, I mean, like, yeah, how would you describe that? Honesty, authenticity.
First and foremost, I think you need to love yourself. And you have to, you know, what I've said in the past is.
Wait, hold on. Oh, so I can't go? Just go fix somebody and make myself better?
that's part of actually helping yourself and staying in recovery. But you have to be able to love yourself. You can't just be out there, you know, flailing around, helping others, because are you really helping them? You know, what are you really even doing?
Yeah.
What are your motives here? Are you just trying to feel better for the moment? Don't get me wrong. Service work, helping others. That's what we do. We are right. Agents of God, right. You know, and we are here to help and serve others. Authenticity, you have to be able to love yourself enough to be vulnerable and put yourself out there to actually make a difference in this world, to humble yourself and say, listen, you know what? I'm here. I was in your shoes or not in your shoes, but I'm going to walk this path with you regardless of whether or not I think it's correct. Showing empathy is huge. Empathizing with a person. You do not have to know anything about that person to empathize, to actually just have empathy for them, to put yourself in their shoes, to walk in their shoes, to imagine what it is like to walk in their shoes. Empathy, authenticity, the best of our ability to be non-judgmental is huge. If we're being authentic and we are empathizing with them, it's a little tough to be non-judgmental. I can rattle off a bunch.
So we can't go tell them what their problem is?
Right. Because they may not even know they have a problem, and maybe it's your problem, not theirs.
Right.
that would be projecting, you know, our problems onto someone else. Empathy, compassion, authenticity, and love, being genuine and loving someone. You know, I can rattle off a million different reasons, you know, on how to love the unlovable. There aren't just three, it's just a combination.
So what do we accomplish when we take the time to move out of ourselves and love the unlovable? What do we accomplish when that happens? Not only for us, but for the person that's being loved.
Well, I suppose that kind of renders back to your motives. What are your motives? I mean, if somebody's motives are self-seeking and selfish, they're going to accomplish, you know, I don't know. They're going to accomplish ego, I guess. They're going to, I'm not certain. That's a tough one. It depends on your motives. I know for me, accomplishing what I accomplish when I'm able to help one person. Oh, he's laughing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Look at that smiley face.
Hi, baby. That's so fun.
Okay. Thank you.
It's what?
It's 10 to 2.
Oh, 10 to 2. So I know some of the feelings of accomplishment that I felt while working with others is that joy that I was talking about, that joy, that happiness, that genuine feeling of being real with another person, that human connection of just being authentic and having a relationship, whatever that relationship looks like, whether that person is busy with a, you know, tying his arm off in the corner trying to find the right bane, and I'm talking to him on how to stay safe, or how much are you putting in the needle right now? Do I need to have my Narcan ready? Mm-hmm. Whatever the relationship is it just, it is what it is. And being able to have that is joyful and happiness. And that's what I feel when I'm of service to others. I'm outside of my head. I get to relate to other people. I've been given the opportunity to share my higher power's world with others, a chance of recovery. Often people don't want to hear it, and that's just fine, so I don't say it.
Yeah.
But I still get to sit there with them, you know. Well, I was able to sit with people in their hotel room while they were shooting up, trying to find the safest way possible for them to shoot up. And that's kindness.
Yeah. I did a teaching here. There's another part of our ministry called the People's Seminary. Bob was teaching a 3-day course here from that. And I basically beat him into submission about doing a teaching on harm reduction.
Oh, yeah. Harm reduction is great.
Isn't it wonderful?
Yeah, all day long I could go off on harm reduction.
But in that, I had Randall from...
From the Needle Exchange.
From the Needle Exchange.
Phoenix Rise.
Come mm-hmm. with me. And then I had Monica Weider come. Mm-hmm. She runs Ohana.
Yep, she... another great support for family members of addicts.
Yeah, she came and they stood with me, and they both... Randall shared numbers and stuff like
great
that.
Great statistics, yep, and how many needles.
Monica came in and shared with the group about taking the role that she had to take as an enabler for her mom to keep her son alive.
Yep.
By taking him to get clean needles because she knew he was going to use.
Yeah.
And then the role that actually having an influx of clean, free needles into the community can actually bring down disease rates.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought in a biblical model of the parable of the Good Samaritan about how we just need to care for them because they don't know who they are yet. Or that's the context that I put it in for these big brain college students. So as we move to wrap up, I'm going to ask you just a couple yes or no questions. Treatment is a good thing.
For the person who wants treatment,
okay.
Yes.
Harm reduction is a good thing.
For the person who wants or needs harm reduction, yes.
Persecution for being an addict, is that a good thing or a bad
thing? Persecution?
For being an addict, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Is that a setup?
Okay, so I think I know where that one's going to go. And just, I want to do this again with you. And looking... towards that, I'd like for you to start thinking of, like, what is it that we can do better?
Ah.
I know there's a lot, and we could be here for hours about talking about the stuff that we could do better. But looking forward to next time. That's if you're up for another one of these conversations.
Yeah, I could do this all day long. Alvin laughs, but I could do this all day long. This is what I do. And even just talking about it is just amazing and thrilling and joy and happiness. Even talking about how we can meet people where they're at and just love them is fantastic. There's gum underneath this chair. So wait a minute. I have a question though. Yeah. You can edit that part out, Alvin. You don't have to. I mean, that's real. That's authentic.
That's true.
It's authentic.
And it goes to the fact that we said that this was unscripted.
For sure.
Yeah.
So leave that part in, Alvin.
Yeah. Okay.
So your question was, you want me to think about, pardon me, you didn't have a question. You would like me to start thinking about what can we do better. But who are you talking about? Are you talking about as individuals? Are you talking about the community? Are you talking about professionals?
As individuals, as a community.
Oh.
This is a podcast that goes out to a lot of people of faith.
Yeah.
They want to be better at loving the unlovable in their faith context.
Oh.
So, you know, so many churches here in the Valley want to get in touch with the suffering community and help in that social justice aspect, right? But they have no idea how to. But then also you have churches here in Burlington that when you show up as an addict and ask for help, they say, they walk you out and say, we contribute to other organizations for that. Go see them.
Sure.
So, I've had that happen to me. So yeah, it's like, you know, what can we do better? What can we do better as not only as individuals, but what can we do better as a church? What can we do better as a society? Because people are being abandoned and left on the street in a lot of cases with nobody to really care about them. But there's a whole group of people that want to care about them. They just don't know how.
Fine. I'll think about that. But I want you to think about that as well. And I would like to have a two-way conversation about that.
Touché. Fine. Okay.
We at can the do... next podcast.
Okay. I'm writing this down right now.
I would like to explore ideas with you.
Hold on. Remove foot from mouth.
No.
No. What can we do better?
Yeah, think about it. And why don't we just have like a freestyle conversation about it and both bring opinions or thoughts or brainstorms to the table? Because I'm not just the professional. You're the professional. Alvin's a professional. We are all professional in coming up with ideas on how to make things better.
Yeah.
And it takes a village. It takes a community to make even just one small movement of change to make things better.
Absolutely. So this is the end of my time with Keely. Thank you for listening to Hold Fast Podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to Ollie as much as we did.
Oh, baby.
I hope that this conversation wasn't too all over the board for you.
Oh, was it?
No.
I kind of feel like it was.
But we get, you know, I know a lot of big brains that everything has to line up in a certain way. And so if they fall out of routine, they're freaking out.
Okay.
So
this is for all the big brains out there. Good luck.
Pretty much. Thanks for listening to Hold Fast Podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you. Is that it? Can you turn it off now?
Yeah. You're going to say some stuff?
No, I'm going to think about what I said.